The current and international affairs commentator Josie Pagani with us on Skype. And in our Wellington studio, the economic commentator Bernard Hickey. Kia ora katoa. Josie, it's been a while. Welcome.
Kia ora. Lovely to be here.
I see Bernard.
I feel quite sad listening to that Roger Moore song. Roger Moore.
Roger Moore.
No.
I know. Well, the whole thing's worth listening to, actually, but I thought, no, I've got to talk to the panellists. And, of course, I see you around the traps, Bernard, but not for a few weeks, so welcome to you as well.
Morena.
Morena. The referenda, first of all, can I ask you about the results? End-of-life choice, yes, but no legal recreational controlled cannabis. Your assessment of both those results. Josie, you first.
The cannabis one, I was actually surprised with, because everyone was predicting, you know, the Chloe Swarbrick did so well in Auckland Central, she won. There was a sense of because there was such a landslide for Labor that maybe this meant that cannabis and euthanasia would both go through. But it hasn't. It's roughly 50-50, isn't it? I mean, just a little bit more of us don't want it legalised. The interesting thing is how angry the left are with Jacinda for not coming out and saying what her position was on cannabis beforehand, because they think with her stellar popularity she could have swayed it.
That was a political call, though, wasn't it?
Yes, but there's a lot of Twitter noise about this and so on. But there is some internal polling which shows that I think about 55% of Labor voters didn't want it legalized. So, or only 55% voted yes. So,
right.
So you know, again, 50-50 even with Labor voters, and 49% of Wellingtonians voted no. So, we're meant to be very woke in Wellington, but
yes,
clearly not as woke as people thought.
Woke Wellington. Yes, I saw Tova O'Brien float the possibility, Bernard, that Chloe Swarbrick's win in Auckland Central could have been indicative. I suppose another hypothesis is that Conservative voters gave Jacinda their gratitude but didn't want to get too liberal about other matters. The actual election of the government exhausted New Zealand's quota of progressive for a while.
Yeah, I think there was too much uncertainty around what it would mean. We still didn't have a clear idea on what regulation would look like. And we hadn't really had a really tough debate on it because of COVID and lots of other things. So I think the uncertainty and so many things are going on at the moment that people, when they're a little bit afraid, they take the most conservative option. And the Prime Minister was very aware of that. And she chose essentially what she saw as the greater good, which was Labor in power, than getting this over the line. I think Chloe and no doubt a few others will be putting their ballots into that biscuit tin to try and get a private members bill out. And that would be, a good way to have another crack at it without the pressure of a referendum and with the chance to have a really good, hard, get the fine detail of what legalisation and sale would mean. And also just to reassure people in business that you've got to remember the whole drug testing thing has changed the way we work, particularly in construction, a lot of areas like that. And for a lot of employers, they were really uncertain about what this meant. Could they do drug testing anymore? Could they use it to stop the people that they didn't want to work for them to work for them? There was a lot of uncertainty. So hopefully we'll get a lot more and a chance to have another crack at it.
Yeah, although probably not in the short term.
No.
Chloe Swarbrick actually thinks cannabis could still get over the line, but nobody else seems to. She said this.
We also were up against a tide of misinformation and some pretty poor form campaigning from others.
Okay, can I ask you about that before we leave the topic? So the Yes camp ran an evidence-based and compassionate campaign up against that tide of misinformation. Josie, is that entirely...
Yeah.
Is that entirely fair? Because New Zealanders would have voted with a gut feeling, many of them, and their gut feeling probably maybe was that people aren't persecuted the way they used to be, don't like the idea of it being normalised for the young and so on. Was it necessarily a wrong opinion?
No, and I think that's completely unfair. And I'm saying that what Chloe said, because I say that as somebody who reluctantly voted yes. And the reason I reluctantly voted yes was that my daughter had an operation that year. She had actually needed you know, she was on morphine and terrible pain relief. And we tried some, we couldn't get any medical marijuana, so we tried some. And I thought, well, I can't in all honesty vote no, having tried to get some to give my daughter some pain relief. And I know that it wasn't about medical marijuana. It was about legalizing, you know, recreational use. But I think that's completely unfair because people like me were really worried about the harm in communities that actually aren't, you know, your liberal dope smoking on a Friday night and, in woke Wellington, that we were worried about communities where it's just so prevalent, it's destroying young lives. And I've got teenage kids as well, and I see their kids, some of their friends, smoking a lot of dope. And so, you don't want to kind of do it as a choice issue, as a libertarian issue. You have a glass of wine, why can't I have a joint? Well, actually, because I'm really worried about the harm of that joint just as much as I'm worried about the harm of alcohol. So I felt like they slightly patronised people who were genuinely concerned about the risk.
Okay, that's an interesting summation. All right, Bernard, as for euthanasia, David Seymour was overjoyed.
Look, I'm just feeling fantastic. It gives me so much love for this country that we have chosen to give those people suffering some real choice and control and compassion at the end of their life.
The headline on TVNZ, Bernard, coercion, the red flag that doctors will be looking out for as euthanasia becomes legal. Does that sum up the principal secular concern here, if you're not a doctor with ethical objections? And are you confident the law will continue to protect against coercion as tweaks are suggested and adjustments may be made in the years ahead?
You'd have to hope so. I'm less concerned about this than some others because it takes quite a lot of effort to get this stuff through, and there will be a lot of people with their antenna up looking for potential red flags, and I suspect it's going to be much harder than a lot of people think to do bad things with this legislation. But, hey, you've got to congratulate David Seymour. A lot of MPs spend decades in Parliament and achieve virtually nothing, and through years of hard work, he's done something substantial, and I suspect ten MPs is in part a reward from an electorate who see good work from an MP come to fruition.
Can you name those other MPs, Bernard? No. Sorry, Josie, you were going to say.
I was just going to say that's absolutely right. And one of the things that happened over the last sort of year or so, I was actually on radio talking about, my concerns about euthanasia, exactly the coercion issue you talk about, which it's easy for the pro-euthanasia lobby to kind of just skate over and go, no, we'll have tests in place, it'll be fine. Well, it's a very subtle grey area, and there are vulnerable people that you think, elderly people that you really do worry that there will be some coercion. So I said this on the radio, and straight after I got a call from David Seymour saying, look, understand your concerns, let me convince you how those concerns will be addressed. I was really impressed with that. And I think, the fact that ACT has sort of reached out across the political spectrum to talk to people that they normally disagree with or disagree with them is the reason why they've got 10 MPs, some of whom we can't name right now.
All right, let's go to overseas politics and who's going to win in the United States. Josie, you've been swatting this up for a TV appearance on Wednesday, so how are the swing states looking?
Oh, it's
I'm writing this down, Josie. I want to make sure that when your prediction comes, I've got it on paper, and then I can come back to you after the election.
One of my favourite US strategists said the other day, I got into politics because I was really bad at maths. Little did I know that numbers would matter so much. And I feel a little bit the same way. But I listened to a group of strategists, a sort of Chatham House meeting just last night, actually. And these are American strategists who are the best of the best. And I just sat there and listened. And look, their summary, to sum it up very briefly, that there's a lot of reasons to feel really bullish about Biden's road to victory. This is looking really good, but there's a whole lot of reasons to feel anxious too. So the good reasons, you're right, Jim, that the states, it's those battleground states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and so on. But the interesting thing that gives people hope is that the breadth of Biden's support is encroaching into states that they wouldn't normally be competitive in at all, like Georgia, Texas, Florida. So, you know, roughly, there's so many polls around, and they're all slightly different. So the battleground states, basically, Trump won them by 1 or 2% in 2016. Right now, on average, Biden has, you know, a kind of 4 to 8% lead. So that's quite a big difference if you think that Trump only won them by 1 or 2%. So I'm talking about, you know, Wisconsin. Yeah. Pennsylvania and so on. And nationally, the popular vote, Biden's got about a 10% lead, roughly. You'd have if you sort of average out all the polls. So there's a lot to be hopeful about.
The 538 polling site, you know, the best known one these days, says 87% of the time in its simulations to see who will win, Joe Biden wins 12% of the time. Trump does. But Bernard, the Rasmussen polling, more conservative, and of the major pollsters, it was said to have come closest last time, has the gap narrowed. Trump was ahead a couple of days ago. Biden's ahead now. Trump's approval rating positive among likely voters for the first time in a long time. So why is Trump clawing his way back into the race? We're not saying he's going to win it, but why is he clawing his way back, Bernard?
I think he has this amazingly strong base of really enthusiastic support, which we all look at and shake our heads and go, well, where is that coming from? But there's something deep in the culture of parts of America and groups of people that just love him to bits. And you're right, 538.com is a fantastic site to go for. And if I had to put my money on someone, it would be Nate Silver's bets rather than the Rasmussen stuff, which tends to be more conservative and has a weighting which makes Trump look better. However, 538 and Nate Silver are saying Trump has a 10% chance of winning. They do 40,000 simulations, and over those simulations, Trump won 10% of the time. So that gnawing feeling in my stomach is getting worse and worse, because I'd take 10% in a lotto draw, and that is 10% way too much. And we'll all have to just hold tight and hope. Trouble is, we're not going to know on Wednesday or Thursday our time. It could be weeks.
So we should know, Bernard, we should know one of the three southern states, Georgia, North Carolina, or Florida, because they return on the day. They'd return their results on the day. So if Biden wins just one of those outside states that he's, you know, you'd never have predicted he would, if he wins just one of those, that's a clear sign that he will win those battleground states, i.e. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan. Pennsylvania is a bit tighter. So I think if we will get that on election day, but you're right, Pennsylvania and these mail votes that get, you know, that they don't necessarily get voted, you know, till days after, by which time we'll have a plethora of court cases litigating the mail votes and so on. So that's when you could get a perception that Trump might have done better than he really has, because those mail votes haven't been counted and they're predominantly Democrat.
And the trouble is, even if, you know, we get results or some of these surprising states go for Biden, Trump's just going to say, it was a rigged election, let's not count anymore. And then he unleashes all of these judges onto these various test cases and states to try and essentially steal the election back for him. And one of the most sort of interesting numbers out of all of this in the last 4 years is that Trump's administration has appointed more federal judges and Supreme Court justices than any other president, and none of them are black. And all of them are Republican hacks, to be frank. And he has not only, you know, undermined all sorts of protections for the world's oldest democracy, but he has, you know, inserted for decades a layer of pro-Republican justices to, you know, try and screw the scrum for years to come.
Republican enthusiasts, we'll call them, Bernard. We will discuss later on the morning with Karen Kassler, yes, those vexed questions of slow counting, not meeting the Electoral College deadline, the possibility of the 12th Amendment being invoked in the House, voting in the House on the election with one state, one vote per state each. It gets really complicated, but we'll do it before we go today. Thank you for your opinions on that. Now, back home, especially with you on board, Bernard, the housing market spiralling out of control, lending restrictions need to be brought back, says the ASB's Mike Jones. Do you agree?
Yes, and certainly for landlords, who, by the way, have managed to borrow at more than 70% of loan-to-value ratio, over $1 billion in September. Now, that's more than twice what we saw a year ago. We've got a housing market right now that's rising. Prices are rising at double-digit rates in many parts of the country. This is in the worst recession we've ever seen, and this is because our banks are nervous about lending to anyone except someone who has lots of equity in a home and wants to buy another existing home. No risk, no leaky, no quakey, no risk that a developer will fall over. They just want to put their money into housing. And that means that we're inflating a housing market which was worth about $1.1 trillion before COVID. And within the next 3 to 4 months, it is likely to be worth $1.4 trillion.
Wow.
So essentially, anyone who owns property is now fantastically richer. Anyone who isn't is now locked out of the market unless they can marry into wealth. I think the New Zealand version of Tinder should have a little box there to tick.
Bring back arranged marriages.
To say, my parents have property. Marry me because you might get a house. And that's what bankers are actually asking. When you come in to say, I'm interested in buying my first home, the first thing they ask you is, do your mum and dad own property?
Mm.
It's a new landed gentry. And it's awful.
And Josie, rents are going crazy down your way. We've heard this week, well, all over. But so what to do? Because putting all our eggs into ever more expensive real estate seems like a problem we just can't solve right now.
No, and the problem with the new Labor government is, of course, they've boxed themselves into a corner about being able to change the incentives to go out and invest in property, because why wouldn't you? And it's the same old argument. I feel like we've been having it for years. If you're not paying tax on the capital gain, why on earth wouldn't you go out and try and get into the property market if you've got money already? The problem is, as you just said, Jim, we're you know, basically, if you've made your wealth and you're top of the hill, you're not paying any tax on the income you make from your assets and from your housing. If you're the wealth maker of tomorrow heading up the hill, you're paying an unfair amount of the tax burden. So, of course, that's going to play out in rents too. So, yeah, it's all very well, you know, I can sit here and say the same arguments we've said all the time for a capital gains tax. You know, I heard a great quote the other day on Labor Day where someone said, yep, capital, you can get your day off when you can start paying your fair share of tax. But, yeah, so we can argue about the capital gains tax. But
there was the thing is, there was nothing in that agreement that came out yesterday about affordable housing. And there was nothing, no commitments about building new houses or lowering house prices or improving rents, simply some vague comments about homelessness. And the Prime Minister locked herself down for the rest of her natural life about never addressing this. And
that's the problem, isn't it, Bernard? But I still think they ruled out the Greens wealth tax. Now, that doesn't mean, and to try and get to your question, Jim, about what do you do now, given you've got so few choices, it doesn't mean you can't have a land tax. You know, that no one...
Oh, no, she ruled that out. We all asked her that, and she said no. Yeah. And a stamp duty. Is the thing. Once that genie was out of the bottle, all of us journalists then went into rule-out mode, and we managed to get everything in there, and it was all ruled out.
Okay, it's all ruled out. So we've only got 90 seconds to go, but just one aspect of it.
What do you do?
No. Not to decide the future of the country, but to discuss this. Bernard, you're worried about the piles of unused cash sitting in bank accounts.
Mm.
Why? I mean, shouldn't we be worried about our level of private debt? Can you blame Kiwis for not being in debt? Because not all of them can just use the money to buy an overpriced house.
Not when interest rates are 0.02%. That's what it cost the government last week to borrow four-year bonds, $250 million worth of four-year bonds. And we really don't have a debt problem. Private, yes, you could argue, has some households. But actually, when you look at how much it costs to service the debt, it's half the level it was 10 years ago, simply because of lower interest rates. The government needs to use its balance sheet to solve these housing affordability and climate change issues. And the Prime Minister has ruled that out as well, because she's completely connected to the current debt track, which is very low.
Okay. Almost out of time, Jesse.
Very quickly, part of the problem is we've got a stimulus on the monetary side. So we've got incredibly low interest rates because of the OCR. And we're also doing a stimulus on the fiscal side because of COVID. We're pumping $50 billion into the economy. The problem if you're doing both stimulus on both sides, fiscal and monetary, is that you are going to create inequality.